This meeting is being live streamed. It's Jake Taylor and Tobias Carlisle on Value After Hours. Just the two of us today, JT. No third wheel.
Woof. Boy, we removed the safety net.
Stretch
it out already.
add more. I got to try to find where this is being streamed. I can't see the questions.
YouTube, I think.
YouTube, you say.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff's available on YouTube. So what's been happening? You've been traveling?
Had a bit of some travel. Yeah, we can go through
just
that.
Stretch to talk about travel. Yeah. I try and find this.
Okay. Yeah. I last week I was in London, obviously, so I broadcast from London last week. And then this last weekend I went to Greece for the weekend on the way home and had a nice little trip. And now I'm back stateside and slept in my own bed last night for the first time in a while, and it was glorious. Felt so good.
Nothing like getting home after a long week on the road.
Yeah, good to see the family again. See how many inches the boys had grown while I was gone.
How was Greece? What's Greece like?
It was lovely. First time there. It was really pretty. The water is nice and warm, like 80 degrees probably Fahrenheit.
Visit any of those crucible of civilization type spots?
No, not really. It was a pretty quick trip. Next time I'll have to add a little bit more time and actually do some proper sightseeing. I did see the Temple of Poseidon, though. That was the closest thing to history that I got.
Where's that?
Call it like 45-minute drive south of Athens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you see Port of Piraeus?
No. Yeah, I saw literally nothing except that one thing and some water, a little bit of Mediterranean.
Let me give a shout out. I'm going to give 10 minutes of shout
out. Yeah. Where's everybody from?
We got to stretch this out. Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, first in the house. What's up? KSUS, that Kansas? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Milton Keynes, Stockholm. What's up? Panama, Kirchheim, Germany, Las Vegas, Atlanta. Lewes, Delaware, Toronto. I skipped somebody there. Tallahassee. Lots of Torontos. Edmonton. Moss, Portugal. There we go. Living the dream.
Yeah.
Toronto, Nashville. Valparaiso, you win. Ian, hang on. That's not in Chile. Augusta, Turkey, Finland. Yeah, it's a good spread. What's everybody up to? It's good to see everybody.
How's the market treating you, TC?
How is the market treating me? It's been fairly kind, I think, for the last... It's funny, like, that all of the sort of the... I don't know what you call them, factor style analysis
yeah.
seem to suggest that value is having a... it's back to sucking again. And I produced one last week. I went and looked at the French data library has lots of different data series. And you can look at the one I pulled up was cash flow, price to cash flow. Because I always think, if you run price to earnings, someone says, well, what's the cash flow look like? And if you run price to book, someone will tell you how old that is. So
right.
That doesn't work anymore. So I just cut to the chase and I did cash flow. I did evaluate cash flow, which is market capitalization.
I thought you were going to go the other way and start just going price to sales.
Possibly.
Or just eyeballs.
Eyeballs. Clicks.
Yeah.
So price to cash flow. And I do it on a evaluate basis because the question is always, is this a size thing? Is it the smalls? Is it the equal weight? In this instance, it's value weight. So it's market capitalization. I looked at the most expensive 10%, the glamour decile, the expensive decile, the growth decile, whatever you want to call it, the growth portfolio.
Yeah.
Versus the value portfolio, the cheap ones, the low price to the fundamental. And over the full data set, growth, so this is 1951 to present, rebalancing on an annual basis. Each portfolio is about 200-ish names, and it's the top 2,000 names. So it's a reasonable spread.
All right. I like the setup of that.
Value has outperformed growth over that entire period by 20 times.
I don't believe you.
Here's the interesting thing. If we had stopped that analysis in August 2014, value had outperformed growth by 80 times. So since 2014, August 2014.
Wait, 80 times, like a full 80x compounded difference.
Yes.
Okay.
And it was a very smooth chart too. It was quite consistent outperformance. And so since August 2018 to the very bottom, which was about March 2020, the drawdown was 76%. So it's not a drawdown, it's underperformance. So value has underperformed glamour since August 2014 by 76%, which means that you go from 80 times outperforming to 20 times.
Yeah.
Over the full data set by adding on the additional 10 years at the end. That's a very long period. It's a very long drawdown. So I think you could be forgiven for looking at value over the last like 10 years now and saying this really doesn't work. You've done a lot.
Yeah.
Can't afford to lag by that much.
Collapse really in the data set, right?
There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it to the point where you probably should be asking, is this fundamentally broken? And I don't have a really good answer other than my instinct, intuition that it's not. But I kept on going with the analysis. So I looked at the comparison, I looked at the drawdown, and then I looked at the yield across those portfolios. So the yield in the Glamour portfolio is about as low as it has ever been through the entire day. It's basically just squashed down over the full set. And the yield on the value portfolio is a little bit over, it's better than average, but it's not
dramatic.
It's not as high as it has ever been. It's better than average. Yeah. But relative value relative to growth is sort of.
What are those numbers are we saying there? What was like the, what's the yield roughly on each one of those ballpark?
Let me look at that. It shouldn't be that hard to find, but it's. I was surprised actually it wasn't quite as stretched as I thought it was going to be. Let me pull this one up. So the growth portfolio is like 1%.
Ugh.
Value, I would say, is about 13, which is
that's the
differential between
the
two.
Probably.
We're probably in the top five in terms of differential. Like I still think 1999 was the broadest, and then 2000 was third. So 2021 was second, and now we're in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 out of like 72 years. So we're in the
top decile.
Top 5%. Yeah, top 5%, I would say. This is all US data too, by the way.
Interesting. So the general lay is that top end, pretty dang expensive.
Yeah,
more bottom expensive end, than it's ever been. Kind of average-ish.
Maybe a bit better than average, but yeah.
A little better average-ish. Than average, but not like, oh my God, you're getting absolutely a steal relatively
I think relatively speaking, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, relatively speaking, yes.
You want to be in value, but on an absolute basis, I still think you probably get slightly better returns than average, but not like, I don't think it's going to be a 2000 where growth gets crushed and value just massively outperforms through that period.
So what's your base rate outcome then from here? Is it negative? Negative for the glamour? Let's say 10 years from now, we have this conversation. Is it zero, slightly positive, or negative for glamour? And then the value basket, do you put it at slightly positive or reasonably positive?
So that's a good question.
Only down a little and the other one's down a lot.
Even over the 20%, accounting for that drawdown, you know, the underperformance since 2014, the outperformance of value over growth over that full set is 5% a year, which is a big up. That's massive. It's like 15 versus 20.
That's an insane number over a compounded series.
And so I would say now growth is, I don't know, is it negative? I don't know. But it's that yield is so low. It's hard to see how that multiple expands much from there. If anything, it goes the other way to go back to its long run average, which might be 4 or 5%, something like that.
It is hard to imagine that there's what levers do you have left to pull from here? I don't know.
So I'm not, you know, there's no quant value person out there who's just pulling on price to a multiple. Nobody's doing that. It's just that's what they call value, the value bucket, to distinguish it from other measures like quality, which are returns on invested capital and the conversion of earnings into cash flows, then what they do with the cash flows once they come in, do they buy back stock? What do they do? So quality, that quality metric, which you can split out, has been, that's been helping people outperform. Quality is looking historically pretty good. I think the forward mirror for quality is looking pretty squashed as well. I think it's had such a good run. But then I don't know, like, is that merely by virtue of the fact that it's sort of, that's describing a lot of the bigger end of town.
Right.
And they're caught in there. It's a funny time. I mean, I looked on the acquirers multiple, on the Alpha Architect site. You know, they've got all the different value metrics there.
Mm-hmm. That dashboard.
EBITDA continues to be, like, it hasn't been updated yet. It'll be updated in the next few days. EBITDA continues to be the widest spread, but price earnings is also a wide spread at the moment. Cash flow is actually, it looks to me like it's like long run average, not massively stretched.
Wonder what that's, what's that a symptom of? I'd have to have a think through the accounting, why that might be.
I can't figure that one out either. I have noticed that in backtests that the value, the cash flow portfolios have done a lot better over the last, particularly since 2020. Cash flow portfolios have done well, whereas like operating earnings portfolios have not. I don't know why. Sometimes it's just randomness. Like that just happens in the data. You know, Jim O'Shaughnessy famously, when he first came out with What Works on Wall Street, said price to sales is the king, top of the income statement.
Cleanest.
So on and so on. Cleanest. And then changed his mind subsequently to an EBITDA, EV, EBITDA type metric, and then changed his mind again to a combo saying use them all because there's just noise in them. And it doesn't, I don't know if it just, they pick up a sector that's hot.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, there's, I would say that the other issue is that accounting reflects, it does its best to try to reflect what is happening in the real world and economically. And sometimes some companies, their accounting is much closer to reality than other companies, just from the pure fact of just the way that GAAP treats things. And that's like, as Buffett said lots of times, like the accounting is a place to start, not necessarily a place to finish. So if you're doing more deep dive analysis.
Let's do some questions. We got some good input. We're going to need probably more, we'll be referring to the questions.
Yeah, it's a special mailbag episode of Value After Hours.
Does the same breakdown occur ex-US or does the factor hold up better? So I'm not sure about that because, you know, if emerging markets, everything looks to me like value versus the index. So emerging markets look like value versus the index. Probably value emerging markets are destroyed. Anything that's not S&P 500 looks pretty sickly at the moment. S&P 500 is just incredibly, like if you're small, if you're value, if you're quality even, I think hasn't done as well. Nothing.
It's a beast, huh?
I mean, it's a pretty good portfolio when you look at that top, the top names in it. Yeah, it's not like in the 80s when the top name was like Exxon or something like that. The top name now is, you know, whatever it is, Apple, Google, Apple. Microsoft.
Yeah, those are okay companies. They might have
better
than average. They might have a little franchise going there. I don't know.
Yeah, value, small cap value. I think small cap value. So I just did this a little analysis today, just looking across my portfolios. I think small cap value is getting close to about as high forward return as I have seen.
Mm.
Mid-cap values.
Performance has been that bad.
Yeah. I think
that's another way of saying that.
It was like, it had this very, very brief run from October 2020 to like April 2021. And I would say like April or May 2021 is probably the peak still for those indexes. Mm. Small value, small and value.
The problem is that you just never can tell when it's going to close that gap. And it can happen so violently that you just can't, there's no timing it, right?
No, well, I don't think you can time it. Yeah. I think that's the answer. You have to not, you have to be there for the, when it happens, but then you probably endure the, it's not always the way. Like I could easily see that at some point this all reverses and we'll be 10 years down the path with SPY.
Yeah.
Having made no progress and probably still looking pretty expensive at that point, potentially.
Well, all depends on what the underlying does. I mean, if you get, well, maybe, it depends on the turnover too. I mean, you could over 10 years, you can turn over a lot of the companies out of there that are the companies that are working now. And that's, it's, it is an evolutionary process within SPY.
That's a good point. Let me, Meb had a tweet today. Our How many Meb? Of the 10 most valuable tech stocks in the world at the peak of the dot-com bubble beat the market by the time of the next bull market peak in 2007?
Oh, gosh.
I'll give you the name. See if that helps.
Yeah, that'll help.
Microsoft.
No.
Cisco.
No.
Intel.
Ooh, maybe.
No. IBM. No.
Doubtful.
America Online. No.
That one's an easy.
Oracle. No. Dell Computer. No. Sun Microsystems. No. Qualcomm. No. Hewlett Packard. No. None of them.
Ugh.
All right. Here's the next question, though. How many were ahead at the end of 2022?
Okay.
Fully 23 years after the dot-com bubble crested.
All those same names?
Yep.
Oh, gosh. Microsoft.
That's it. You got it.
I'm glad you stopped me before I added more wrong answers. Wow.
Yeah.
You can't be real enthusiastic about those odds, right? Like, bellwether, best, and all those, like in 99, you would have given me totally logical and very, very believable reasons why all of those were dominant companies for the next 20 years, right?
I mean, in that list, yeah. In that list, there's Cisco and Oracle,
which, Intel, you know, they're still good 90, businesses. Intel, 95% yeah. market share at that point. What other companies do you know has like an entire huge industry locked up at 95% market share?
I mean, Hewlett Packard, Qualcomm, Sun Microsystems, Qualcomm, Dell Computer, Oracle, America Online.
Yeah, you would have IBM. Told me network effects, first mover advantage, ability to like outspend on R&D for compared to everyone else. Never, you could never catch them. And you would have, I mean, all of those would have been like very, no one would have laughed you out of the room at that point.
You could have held them all. I think it's one of the things it really demonstrates is that no one knows what's going to happen. And businesses, when they look really, I mean, if the lever that you're pulling on is the quality of the business, it's hard because they often look good because they've had that cyclical tailwind at their back for a period, which they had. You know, Cisco is the one. I found some people have made some comparisons between Cisco and NVIDIA because Cisco had, there was that panic for internet routers at the end of the 99-2000 and everybody front-end loaded 5 years of buying.
Yeah.
And helped Cisco out, perhaps in the same way people have front-end loaded 5 years of buying for NVIDIA. I don't know. I'm not close enough to it, but it just wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, it's really hard to say, but if you do look back at just chips in general, that industry has been so boom bust over the years. I mean, just absolute annihilation of companies over
time. Why is it so boom bust? Why is that?
Huge fixed costs, long lead times in getting ramping up. So you're planning, and let's say I wanted to put, you know, I wanted to be able to service my customers with a bunch of more chips. Well, I needed to start probably five plus years ago building that factory to be ready. So you're always just hoping that like the future is going to be as bright. And when you have huge fixed costs and you show up, like you still have to move some units to just even try and cover your fixed costs, but you're eating your marginal costs, or you're eating your flexible costs at that point. And I mean, it's, you end up with an absolute bloodbath.
I got a question here. I got a few. What do you think of the reinsurance market? Are you following that? at all?
I mean, a little bit. I'm following more general the insurance industry, not reinsurance quite as closely, but I know insurance has been pretty firm lately. These companies are, I think, getting pretty good pricing right now.
There seems to be some difficulty getting insurance in California and Florida, but just my kids' soccer, like they had to move everything around because they couldn't get insurance in some of the fields. Strange.
Yeah. Well, I mean, inflation finds its way into a lot of places, including insurance premiums. I mean,
yeah.
When you have cars that ran up 50%, when you have basic materials that are much more expensive now, so the repair costs are higher, Geico is not going to eat that. Like, they're going to pass it on the next time that the contract comes up in a year. So yeah, I mean, premiums, or, you know, let's take Florida and storms. And if it's going to be expensive to solve that problem for you that occurred that you were insured for, it's going to be more expensive the next time you come around to have to buy that same coverage.
California does something weird too, where they don't allow them to reinsure some of the stuff, or they don't allow them to include the cost of reinsurance. I don't fully understand it. I saw a CBS news article on it that reinforced some of my priors.
So oh, yeah.
Wasn't as critical as it could have been.
Well, that's part of the fun. That confirmation bias.
All right, here's one. This is one that I don't really know either. This is sort of borderline economic, but how big an impact does the student loan repayments starting have on the economy, on the marginal consumer?
Well, that one's too easy for me, so I'm going to let you take that one, TC.
I have nothing further to add. Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know. Some impact. I have no idea. Millennials and their avocado toasts out.
I mean, of course, we can all paint the pictures of that, right? Where it's like, well, yeah, all the disposable income that was going to Pelotons and I don't know, whatever else. Yeah, avocado toast gets soaked up now in student loan payments. But these government-led things, you know, especially in election years, they have a way of being the can getting kicked even further down the road, right? Like, how many years do they keep renewing, like, the electric vehicle subsidy programs and the renewables, solar and wind credits, all that stuff? Like, it's they come due. There's always a question of, oh, are they going to put them back on? And then last minute they put it back on again. And so I don't know. I mean, these things are really hard to. I'm not sure how much of you can depend on it for any real, like, investment thesis. Like, if that's your thesis for something, like, oh boy, I don't know. Like, try to find something easier to figure out.
When you're idiosyncratic discretionary value, so you're not trying to manage to any given exposure. You're just going to buy something when you find it cheap or otherwise, and you're sizing. So you're not too concentrated. I don't know exactly how concentrated you get in client accounts, but not too concentrated. So below 10%, something like that. I don't know what you get, 5%, something like that.
It depends on how well I know it. I can go higher than that.
Okay.
But yeah.
How hard are you finding it to find positions now? How do you feel about the market at the moment?
Yeah, it's harder for sure.
Harder than when? October last year.
But I'd go even further back before I would say, like, it's harder than like during COVID, harder than 2020. Probably not harder than 2019 though, and 17 and 18.
I can't even remember.
And 19. I
can't remember.
Those felt harder. Let's just say I had more cash than I do now. But a lot of that is things that I bought, you know, a couple of years ago feel kind of fully priced and I just haven't sold them, but I've been kind of letting them run a little bit more than probably normal because I don't have a lot of great things to replace behind them. So, but it's not, I guess my prospective returns from today's portfolio don't feel quite as strong as they did probably you know, certainly like 2 years ago, or 2.5, 3 years ago. But that's because a lot of the names have run up in the meantime. I mean, that's just the nature of it. You know, when I was, and I, you know, I don't always love talking individual names, but, you know, when I bought Fairfax 3 years ago, it was like, I don't know, 0.6 or something, half 0.5 price to book at that point. Like that felt like there was a lot of meat on that bone that was available. You know, when I bought energy companies at when prices, oil prices were negative, I just needed them to survive at that point. Like, and I felt like there was a good chance of ROEs coming back to be off of zero to be pretty strong at that point. And I was, you know, I stand to earn a lot of that ROE plus the multiple expansion that comes from when you get out of, like, you know, completely blood in the streets. But that doesn't really describe today's case anymore. Like they're making pretty decent money still. They're retiring shares. They're doing dividends. They're been reasonably okay, at least like some of the majors in on CapEx, not getting too crazy with it. But, you know, I mean, you're at quite a bit different multiples than it when I bought. So you just can't feel like you're, like the spring doesn't feel as loaded as it did when I was buying them, for sure.
Sort of implicit in what you just said, there's a distinction between buying and selling, right? So you buy and you're looking for everything to be lined up perfectly correctly. And then holding is a different question, right? You're sort of like, now we're, how close are we getting to the value, to my,
yeah,
to I kind of,
I feel like I'm, I agree with Munger at when he was, I think 97, when he said, I'm still kind of figuring out my sell criteria. and, you know, I think his words on marriage actually apply reasonably well to this, which is, you know, when you go into the marriage, you should have your eyes wide open, but once you're in it, you should have your eyes like a little bit closed. And I think that same could be true for your portfolio, where have your eyes wide open on valuation. But as you own it over time, you know, I think being too strict with valuation sometimes can make you sell at too early. And then what, especially if you don't have anything readily to put into it at that point. So I've been, or said another way, like I think being a value buyer and a bit of a growth holder is, yeah, might be a reasonable thing to do.
I say quality holder.
Quality. Yeah, sure.
But also you can't, you know, obviously you can't take, you can't ignore the valuation either. You can't have it be.
No, but I think maybe like forcing it to an extreme, or having your bar a little bit higher up, like I would never buy here, but I can hold here for a while and maybe it grows into that. Maybe it doesn't, but sometimes I think we're all, I've been guilty in the past, certainly of punching out of something too soon and not, when you kind of get a win earlier and then you leave a lot of money on the table potentially. And especially if it's to just go into cash and you don't have anything readily available to put it into that seems super attractive.
Yeah. I had some holdings last year in the home builders and like a lot of adjacent stuff like Williams Sonoma, which I continue to hold, like that kind of stuff. Boise Cascade, which I also continue to hold. It's like all kind of adjacent, or
yeah,
not a builder, but it's selling into that same market. And as it's run up, like I've been, there's no discretionary kind of element to me selling some of these things. Like there has to be better opportunities in there, but I don't know. Like at any given, you shake the opportunity set every time you rebalance.
Right.
And I always hope for those things that something else comes in and pushes them out, because yeah,
feels like you already kind of rung that.
Yeah. And so my discretionary
squeeze that lemon.
And they're not like they're good businesses. They're pretty good businesses, but they're not great businesses, and they're definitely cyclical.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like we're close to the end of that cycle. I really want to get out, but like they're in there in the opportunity. They're still in there, so
yeah,
I just keep on
holding.
Yeah,
they still must be reasonably priced if they're still in there, right?
It's been good fortune for me that I haven't, because they've continued to work it, even though I just, like, along with everybody else, are just completely shocked that they continue to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of this too came from a little study that I did back when I was teaching way, way back in the days. And it was an examination of all of the value studies, right? And comparing that to the value gurus and, yeah, looking at them in a kind of longitudinal study of like, okay, in this year, how'd the studies do aggregated? How did the managers do? And then just running through in time. And of course, you know, all of the caveat imperator of in this world of studies where it's like, you know, transaction costs, trading costs, and taxes, all these things that people cite for why you can't fully depend upon these studies. And that's fair. But one of the things I noticed, and by the way, like the studies absolutely trounced the managers, the gurus, just killed them across every single time period. And one of my hypotheses as to why this might have been was that if we think about, you know, taking advantage of some behavioral bias, I think we would all agree that the market can undershoot and also overshoot. And both of those extremes are illogical from the actual price when it's, you know, price and value matching each other. So the value studies, because they're so mechanical, you know, they buy when it's cheap and they hold for a year or 2 years or 3 years, whatever the prescription is, and then they sell and then they trade up. Well, it's possible that they, because it's a time-based kind of effect, it's not necessarily valuation-based, they might participate in capturing both the inefficiency to the downside, as well as if it runs up to a stupid amount that the guru would have sold out of. And so there's not capturing that kind of upside inefficiency.
100%.
I don't know how true that is. It was always just a hypothesis.
That makes sense to me. I mean, you can see it. You can definitely see it. Some things just get hot for whatever reason and they run up way beyond what anybody...
You never would have held it, right? I mean, if you had discretion over that, it would have felt so... it would have felt like you were taking a really stupid risk at that point. And you'd already won. You would want to punch out to lock in the gains. Like every single psychological thing would be making your finger want to push that button to get the hell out, right?
Particularly because the nature of these things is they do tend to return to Earth. It's not like the compounders where
very rarely do you catch like Apple as a net and ride it to, you know,
look, it's fine to overpay for that stuff. Like there's such good businesses, eventually they catch up. That's fine. Don't worry about it. Like nothing like that. I've never bought anything like that in my life. It's always like, that's not true. I've bought plenty of them and sold them when they got to
like a reasonable price.
Fair value.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Bought them at half book, sold them at book.
Right.
Then ran to 10 times book.
Well, and I think that, you know, if we think about the return profile and, you know, a lot of times it is a couple names that will drive the entire outperformance of the portfolio, a power law type of outcome. If you trim those extreme return profiles, boy, you really truncate the total portfolio return at that point. And, you know, if everything else is just kind of a, you know, call it a bunch of OKs and then a few dogs out of there, you know, like you really might be giving up a lot of that potential total return from an aggregated basis.
The VCs always used to say our portfolios have got power law distributions. That's why we have 10 positions and one or two deliver all of the returns.
100 positions. And
well, that's Y Combinator, right? That was there. They said, you get such good right tails, you can't afford to miss the right tail. Therefore, have many more smaller positions and you'll get more money increase your chances of catching one of those.
Right.
And given that any one of them can return the entire value of the portfolio, you might as well be in as many as you can to catch it.
Yeah.
That must also
spray and pray, they call it.
That must be true across. I don't know why that would be different for listed portfolios as well. I think it is all fairly similar. It's just over people don't hold for those periods of time. You're selling all the time. But in those long studies that I have done where you just tell the system not to sell, just to hold everything. So it's not real. Like you don't get any of the capital back. It's imagining that you've got this unlimited supply of capital to invest to. Although you do end up getting about a third of the portfolio capital back over 5 years, which is extraordinary to me that it's as much as that. But it actually makes sense if you're buying on a cheap on a free cash flow basis and the free cash flow yields like 10%.
Yeah.
After 3 years, like that's 30% of the cap of your starting capital has sort of been plus some growth
recycled.
It does make some sense that that's what ends up happening. I think it would be hard to sort of run a portfolio on that basis unless you were explicit at the start, like we're doing a Y Combinator, we're going to buy 100 positions. We know that there's going to be a lot of dead weight in here, and the median stock might not do that well, but the payoff on the right tail is so huge. We don't know which ones it is. That's the funny thing. I go back and look at them. I have no idea prospectively. Some of the names I recognize, so it's a bit of a cheat, but many of them I don't.
I think if we compare time periods too, I think that's important to realize, like the opportunity sets and the way that they're structured. So, you know, Buffett in 1950, it was a continuous conveyor belt smorgasbord of inefficiently priced securities. And so every single time you were trading up, you were just kind of keeping that edge sharp on the portfolio, right? Like buy something, it would run up, trade up into the next thing that was cheap. You know, 2 years later, that had run up. And, you know, that's how he made his best returns, was basically just always keeping that cheapness edge on his portfolio. And that was, you know, you had a nice run rate that you could just continually keep recycling into. Well, I think now it's possible that the cheapness, the inefficiencies come in punctuated time periods now, where it's like, yeah, the market's a hell of a lot more efficient over most periods of time, but then occasionally it just gets stupid one direction or another. And so you have to like wait around that whole time period when it's mostly pretty efficient. And then when those things come, you have to be willing to swing big. So that's much more of kind of a Munger Daily Journal management approach, right? Like do nothing for a really long stretch and then feast when it's put out for you. But you have to, the industry is not really structured to capitalize on that style of opportunity set and flow. I think it's much more the like little continuous version that, and you know, always turning the portfolio over. That's like sitting on treasuries for 8 years, like Munger did before you load up completely on three names. Like, I don't know if you can run a business that way, right?
If you're in an industrial and you have businesses that you're ostensibly, you know, running, even though you're not necessarily doing anything, you're sort of at the top, making sure that the capital's not being reinvested. You know, they're not making silly acquisitions and doing things like that. You probably can do that. That you wouldn't expect an ordinary operating business to be making an acquisition every single year or every.
No, of course not. You would know that cyclically there will be times where your competitors will be weakened, and you want to have the resources available to take advantage of that, whether it's taking their customers or their best employees or buying them out completely. I mean, that's what a good anti-fragile operator is always thinking about.
I think also it's worth pointing out when Buffett, who's quite a good investor.
Is he all right?
For that period of time when he was running the Buffett partnerships, like he was holding three names in stuff that was like incredibly illiquid, just impossible to get in and out of.
I think he was more diversified than that, wasn't he? I think it was, I would have guessed it was more like 10 to maybe even 15, because he had three different buckets going. He had like workouts, which is kind of like an arbitrage thing. He had going concern type of, you know, more like buy and
hold-ish.
Yeah, generals. So I think I would imagine that it would have been a little bit more diversified than three.
Pretty concentrated though. Pretty.
In the grants, yeah. Compared to the average investor, he was pretty concentrated.
And then he regularly says in those Buffett partnership letters, I'm aiming for 10% outperformance over the Dow Jones over 10 years.
Oh my gosh. 10% compounded.
I think so. I think 10% over the full, I think it was 10% over 10 years. I don't think it was compounded.
Oh, no, it had to have been higher than that.
That might have been what he achieved. What he said was 10%. Maybe it was over 5 years, but it wasn't. He was saying, for you to tie up your money with me, I'll give you, this is what I think is a reasonable premium over what you can get in the index for less. Mm. It's very modest.
Well, he did better than that.
He did.
He underpromised and overdelivered on that one. Shall we bang out some vegetables?
Please.
Okay.
You've been coasting so far, JT. time to carry this podcast.
Yeah. All right. All aboard. So, you know, I found myself this last weekend in Greece, like I said, and on a boat in the Mediterranean, and as one does.
Look at this guy.
I know.
Who are you?
It's silly, but
who are you?
I know. I don't even know either. But this boat that I was on was it was a kind of a big boat, and it was with some actual like real experienced sailors. Like this wasn't, you know, just like a little dinghy or anything. And you know, it's being such a serious operation. You know, even just going from one island and putting to another one and anchoring for a swim is like a real, it's a real experience. It's not just, you know, like you got to really be paying attention. These are high consequences. So I was hoping that, you know, we could, and I watched this captain and I asked him a bunch of questions to kind of, I like to just learn about like watching anyone in their mastery moment and talking to them is always interesting. And so I was hoping, we might find some business and investment parallel implications from, and hopefully they're kind of relatively obvious, but.
Let this be a lesson. JT never sleeps. He's always looking for podcast content.
Shit, man. You have to. Otherwise, how else can you keep the streak alive, right? You got to be like Cal Ripken. You can't miss practice either. All right. So these are three lessons from like serious boating. All right. So number one, planning before you move and maintaining a margin of safety. So first thing is like, you're always charting out your course before you even get started, right? You don't just take off and then be like, oh, we'll figure out on the way where we're going. And you have to make sure that you aren't traveling over any path that you might run into trouble that you might've been able to avoid, like reefs or sandbars or whatever. You really have to understand your boat and what it's capable of and not capable of, like what size waves can it handle? What depths are safe? What wind speeds are safe to be in? Like there's so much that you have to really understand. And then you also have to just keep a margin of safety in all of those things, all these parameters. Like if it's only good for, you know, 3 meters, let's say, of waves, like you don't go out when it's 3 meter waves. Like you know, it's like you keep away from the line. And like, this is literally Munger's advice about figuring out where you're likely to die and then not going there. Like this is... This isn't hype. Yeah. It's not theoretical in this case. You might actually die if you mess this up. All right. Lesson number two, while you're underway, you're looking for markers and waypoints on the path towards your destination to make sure that you're not deviating from the course of where you think you're supposed to be. And the investment equivalent of this is, I think, like thesis signposts. So any investment you're making, you should be able to set signposts where that would either confirm or deny where you are and are you going where you think, you know, is this proving true or not, like confirming or disconfirming evidence, making sure you're on the right track. And, you know, and then at that point, you know, when you're sailing, you have to be constantly monitoring the weather, the wind, the waves, currents, and making sure that those conditions, you know, because they're always changing, how is that changing with, you know, what your thesis was? And, you know, of course, obviously the same is true for markets. You know, bigger ships can go less places. And, you know, obviously AUM is like a performance anchor, as Buffett has said lots of times. Like you can't bring a big old ship into like a little bay and then, you know, try to get to close to the beach. Turning takes time. So imagine like they were telling me that a full size container ship, like one of those really, really big ones, cruising along at 10 miles an hour. If you were to throw it into reverse, full reverse, it would take still 1 mile to stop.
I mean, you're going to say a day.
No. But a mile, I mean, that's picture like how far a mile is from offshore. Like if you were to heading towards something you were going to hit and you went full reverse, I mean, a mile is a lot of ground to still cover or sea to cover. And I mean, there's such serious inertia at work here. I mean, you really have to plan ahead. And this kind of reminds me of Bezos when he would be congratulated on a great quarter. He would then say, well, thank you, but that quarter was baked 3 years ago, right? And I think it's always like that. So another way of saying, I think this is really especially true in the investment world, is that the inputs are the outputs from the inputs are so badly lagged, right? Like you do the work and then a lot, you know, you set your course, you set your investment thesis, and a lot of times you won't know if you're right or wrong and you won't get paid for years in some cases. And that's similar to, what ends up happening is you have to be very careful to not continually oversteer and have too many inputs. And it was really interesting. Like I was watching the captain steering this boat and, you know, as you're kind of like, you know, drifting a little left or a little right or port or starboard, I guess they call it. He would start turning the wheel and then like 10 seconds later, the boat would start to go in the direction that he turned. And then by the time we were already moving that direction, like he's already starting to steer it back the other direction, you know, for the next 10 second increment. And I think that there's kind of something analogous in the investment world where, you know, you kind of want to figure out a little bit like where the puck is going and skate to where it's going and not be chasing everything. Like if you can get out ahead of it a little bit, I think you're a pretty big advantage. Lesson number three is around resilience. And, you know, Mother Nature is obviously very unforgiving. And as one of my friends said, like it's all left tails in the ocean, no right tails out there. To improve your chances of responding to a challenge successfully, you have to have procedures for every contingency that you can imagine. And, you know, that response has to be executed coldly, coordinated, and without much surprise if you can help it. Like you want it to say, like, if X happens, then we do Y together and we know our roles. And, you know, we've discussed this man overboard moment and procedures before on the pod. And actually, UTEMCO, like the University of Texas investment management company, their endowment, they have a pretty nice example. They had this slide that I found that was, it's a liquidity plan for a minus 60% market correction. They basically are like, here's how we're going to reposition the portfolio if that happens. And including a minus 20% single day collapse. Like these are the moves that they're going to make so that they're not just completely caught flat footed by a market panic. And so this is yet another call to action to you if you are an investor to get your man overboard procedure ready before you're in the middle of the storm. We've already asked you to do this a few times. Here's another one. But of course, like there's always going to be surprises and you can't plan for everything. And because of that, like these ships have redundancies for every system that's on there.
Coffee maker. You know,
what's that?
Coffee maker.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that can't go down. You have to have...
That's the most important part of the ship.
That's right. Well, it fuels the team. You know, obviously like communications and radios, they've allowed the exchange of information with other ships and the shore and it's been, you know, it's huge. Like it's such a better system than what was before, but yet there was still this bank of like, I don't know, call it 25 different flags that were all like in these little slots. And I asked them like, what are all these flags for? And they're actually like, you can spell out like they're letters, the flags represent letters. And so you could spell out with someone and communicate with them in an old school fashion if all for whatever reason like radios were down. And they actually keep like a wide range of basic materials on hand for problem solving, you know, with like welders and, you know, machining and steel plates and paint and epoxies and all this stuff. Like you have to be able to fix things when you're out there because things are going to break that you know maybe couldn't have planned for necessarily. And so like there's an element of creativity that's required and responsiveness. In investing, I think it helps to have multiple tools at your disposal like this. Like, you know, maybe it's the ability to understand capital cycle theory, or maybe it's, you have to understand SAF's growth dynamics, or, you know, maybe it's arbitrage or activism or convertible debt or options or hedging or factor analysis, different asset classes, whatever it is. All of these things are just like different tools in your tool belt. And the chances of you finding intelligent things to do increase, I think, as you add more tools and give you more flexibility on how you express intelligent things to do. And so part of it, you know, increasing your resilience is a constant battle with entropy, right? Like every system in the universe naturally decays due to entropy. And the only solution to fighting entropy is you have to constantly add energy, information, or materials from outside of the system into the system to fight entropy. So, you know, the maintenance of a big ship like this is just absolutely constant. I mean, we've done a segment on this already on sailing ship maintenance. I think it was in August of last year, if you want to go find it. It's kind of an interesting story, but like every 5 years, so you're doing continuous maintenance, but every 5 years, they'll do what they call a special survey, which is they take the ship out and they basically like go through every nut and bolt in it. It's a complete overhaul of the boat. And, you know, it's not a bad idea, I don't think, to periodically do a special survey of your own portfolio and assess like if you need a complete overhaul of it. You know, it's really easy to allow these barnacles to accumulate over time, you know, it's rusty bits of your portfolio that could probably use like a little scrubbing and a fresh coat of paint, you know, maybe re-underwriting the thesis. I think it's important to do that periodically and you know, clean out the dead wood. So next thing is that technology can actually kind of remove critical thinking by creating abstraction and increasing fragility in a system. So, you know, a lot of times technology is about turning sensory input into numerical terms, and it's creating models out of what's happening in the real world, and so that you can like have an approximation of it. And it's, you know, I mean, it's like maps that are approximating the territory. Like a map is a technology to help you understand the territory. And, you know, this George Box quote about, you know, all models are wrong, but some are useful. It's very easy to be just staring down at your instruments and then not looking out at the actual ocean. And, you know, there's lots of precision in these instruments that give you answers down to a, you know, a decimal place. And they make you feel like you're being exact in your awareness. And of course, like GPS, depth finders, all those things are game changers for understanding the environment that you're operating in. But often what can really sink your ship is found by just looking out into the real world. And sometimes the risk doesn't show up in your instruments. So you have to keep kind of a first principles based, level-headed awareness of the world, of the investment world, if you can, like looking out. And let's not only, you know, are you doing accounting stuff or spreadsheets or SWOT analysis, but you know, you could spend kind of too much time in there. And sometimes just getting away from your desk and looking out at the real world can protect you from like these obvious risks that aren't captured in your spreadsheet. And, you know, I think a lot of times mathematical rigor is often substituted for simple, basic, kind of holistic understanding of what you're trying to do. Similar to how, you know, if you're steering by instrument instead of just actually looking out up at the real world, you can lose sight of important fundamental things. So, those are three lessons from serious boating that I picked up over the weekend. And hopefully maybe there's some good investment parallels for you there.
There's some good lessons in there. The lag one, I think, is interesting. Lag is tough, particularly in business, because it's what's being reported is the last quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So any changes that are made may not show up in the next quarter or the one after that. It takes a long time for the business to turn around. So what appears to be moving in front of the reporting is just someone who's got a better idea of what's actually happening on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And vice versa. Maybe that's one of the reasons why value has worked so well, buying mean reversion and those things, just having a better idea. Cheapness alone, just front running the lag.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've been around long enough now to watch reasonably up close up like full business turnarounds. And I've even participated in few private ones, and it's amazing how long these things take to play out. I mean, it's like really does not match our human sort of like conscious timelines that we stay aware of. I mean, I know we can all think in years, but actually live through years of watching something slowly turn is a completely different experience than just imagining it hypothetically. And it's a lot more painful to wonder what the hell is taking so long here. But in the real world of business, it turns out it's actually kind of hard to do these things.
When I used to mess around a lot more in options, I always used to find that like just the strike beyond the next quarter, that was the one that was like most people didn't give a shit about that one, because, you know, a year out, people are thinking about that. A quarter out, people are thinking about that. But the strike beyond the next quarter is just like that one doesn't
exist.
It's
a dead zone.
Yeah, you don't need that one. Don't have to worry about that one. So that one's often mispriced, underpriced.
Huh. It's like soft analysis being done on that one by other participants.
Yeah, the lag is real in economics too. We have coincident indicators and we have leading indicators. And I saw something today that said that the lag between when the Fed starts hiking and when it starts showing up in results is 5 quarters, which is a long time.
Mm. Well, it makes sense. I mean, we're talking about the transmission of interest rates into every nook and cranny of an economy. And that's naturally going to take time to filter out and transmit throughout a system. So every little decision at the margin is being done with a new part of information, and it's going to take a while.
It does make sense, but there's also this idea that the market is so forward-looking that it reacts almost immediately to every new bit of information that comes in. And that for some things, that's true.
Yeah, I don't think so. No, I do. I mean, obviously it's true in some ways, but the efficiency I think is mostly there, but it's not completely there. And that changes then all of the math that's done from there. Like it kind of, you can kind of throw a lot of the math away at that point and favor common sense instead, in my humble estimation. Obviously, do your own philosophical work there.
What do you like for a man overboard? Do you have a list of names that you'd like to own and a rough price that you'd like to own them?
Yeah, I try to maintain an inventory of companies that I feel like I understand, but maybe the price just isn't there for me to feel like I'm getting the right risk reward. A lot of times, you know, it's easy to buy more of the names that you really already own and understand when they come in some that, but yeah, it's difficult because ideally you should be measuring opportunity cost of every single dollar at every point in time. And so that would mean then taking a very flexible approach to it. Like you don't know what industry is going to go on sale. You don't know if have you done enough work to be comfortable to buy it? What asset class, you know, might puke for whatever reason. So to be opportunistic, that implies a flexibility. And, you know, I mean, Berkshire's been run this way where it's about the individual day when they show up, like what's the smartest thing to do with each new dollar. And, you know, I think that's the right way to do it, but it is difficult when you want to try to put some structure around it so that you stay in your spots where you know you're smart as well. So, you know, I think there's a constant tension, I guess, between the pre-planning and the ability to be flexible to do things as the opportunities arise.
Why do you think it was such a weird decade for value? Like, why do you think
you gotta save that one for the therapy couch there.
No, I know. I'm gonna ask you now. Why not? Why do you think it was such a weird decade? Because like I always say, like you wrote that great article showing that the dispersion between the cheap stuff and the expensive stuff was as tight as it has ever been. And if I'd have been smarter, I'd have said, well, what then? What does that mean? It means that
and now what?
Quality's probably on sale. You can buy good, better quality stuff for cheaper. And that's the arbitrage. Now it's the other way around.
Alas, you and I were not smart enough to take that next step. But
I read that article. I processed it. I put it up on my
understood
site.
Understood it.
Understood it. Didn't ask the next question.
And then started sucking my thumb, basically. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's interest rate arguments. You know, low rates make these future cash flows not as discounted. There's economies of scale network effect things that are on some of these big businesses that allowed them to scale without much new capital. Like the difference between growing a Facebook versus growing a Standard Oil and the amount of capital that you would need to drive business is just, it's different beasts. So recognizing
interest rates has got to be a big part of that, hasn't it? Like that's the most glaring. The reason I ask before I say that, if we can't diagnose,
tell me the answer before you ask me the question.
Well, I don't know the answer, but but if we can't diagnose the last 10 years, then what hope have we got of being appropriately positioned for the next 10 years? That's kind of my thought.
So we can diagnose. Like, so where did the returns come from? That 16.6% annualized return of the S&P 500 from 2011 to 2021, where did that come from? Revenue growth was pretty normal. Share count shrunks somewhat.
Is that unusual?
No, I think it was a little bit more than normal, but if I remember right, it wasn't extreme. Margins expanded some.
That was unusual. So margins have gone well beyond where they had previously mean reverted.
And that could be some of the explanation of, well, taxes got lower. So that's going to help your corporate taxes were lower. That's going to help your margin. Employees' share of GDP didn't really go a lot of places. So that's going to help your margins if you're a business. Like labor was cheaper. Labor lost.
You think that's because labor got paid with a lot of equity?
I don't know.
Is that like 15% share-based compensation in the service sector?
White
collar rather than service.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell that to like, you know, all the baristas and...
Well, meant to white collar rather than...
Yeah, perhaps.
You know, if you're a big tech employee, you've done pretty well in the SBC.
Dividends were pretty standard. And that leaves then multiple. And multiple carried a huge chunk of that. So what's driving the multiple? the enthusiasm and interest rates drive a lot of the multiple.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we kind of can lay the foundation of where did it come from. That's not really so much like value versus something else, but that's just where did the market's returns come from? So where the next 10 years, like which of those levers are you going to pull to get another great decade? Is it going to be revenue growth? Oh, by the way, like if we remember back to when we talked about this, 2011 to 2021, revenue grew actually slower than 2000 to 2010, which was a lost decade for stocks. So top line was actually worse in that decade where everyone crushed it in the S&P 500. So I don't know what the next 10 years necessarily, but it's hard to imagine that it's going to be, you're not going to get 5%, right? I mean, maybe you'll get GDP or 2%. Yeah, I don't know.
I thought we'll see. 3.2 from using that, but that assumes that we end the decade at the long run average multiple. So we end the decade at like 16, 17 times on a P multiple basis.
Yeah.
And that doesn't account for any margin contraction, but
right.
3.2%, 1.7% of that is dividends. The other, whatever that is, 1.5% on the index.
So revenue's likely to come in at normal. Share count, I don't know how much more you can borrow and buy back shares again. Dividends are probably going to be relatively normal. Share count might actually grow even if companies come up short and have to get money in the door, they issue shares and that will hurt you. Like you actually add to the total share count. Margin, like again, with these really high margins already, like is that going to grow from here? Like, I've been very wrong about the ability to keep growing that, but at some point you got to run up against some ceiling of like what corporate America is allowed to take in this whole system. And then that leaves multiple and you start off with a high multiple. You can go to a higher multiple, but how much of your return are you pulling forward with a high multiple already? It just doesn't leave you real enthusiastic, does it?
And on that cheery note, we made it. I don't know what we're doing next week because JT and I are both at a conference. We got to figure it out. We may be broadcasting with a special guest from there, and we may just be off. But we'll let everybody know.
Yeah, we'll track somebody down and try to do the live session from there. We'll see.
I felt.